From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, comedian Paula Poundstone on romance, politics, and the dubious tactics of her fellow Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelists, and a prototype for social media revolutions, the 16th century Protestant Reformation. But we begin with a nod to the President's Day holiday on Monday with a closer look at the impressive accomplishments and sleazy conduct that characterized the presidency of William Jefferson Clinton. A new documentary examines the legacy of a president divided between idealism and political skill and the persistent personal failures that nearly toppled him.
I remember him saying to me on God knows how many speeches, "Harold, if I can just communicate to enough Americans what we have done and where we want to take the country, we'll win this."
Clinton's deputy chief of staff, Harold Ickes, there, one of many interviewed in Clinton, the latest installment in PBS's American Experience President's Collection. The film debuts on Monday night, that's President's Day, with part two airing the following evening. Barrett Goodman has been writing and directing documentaries for more than 15 years, including the 2010 Peabody and Emmy-winning film Me Lie, and the Academy-nominated Scottsboro, An American Tragedy. He's producer with Chris Durrance and writer and director of the film Clinton, It All Began With Hope. Barrick, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
Two-term president, a presidency of great scandal and great achievement. How do you as a filmmaker begin to unravel a story like that of Bill Clinton?
You go to the sources. We set out from the beginning to get as close to the people who knew him best as possible, starting with his early days in Arkansas. And fortunately for us, people were ready to talk, and so we ended up with nearly 70 on-camera interviews in the film with the people who were there.
Yeah, I guess there is the question of, is it too soon? What would be too soon to do a Clinton documentary? This is time?
Well, that was definitely a topic of argument and debate at American Experience. You know, it is an historical documentary series, and the question was, is this history? And I think, you know, the consensus was that enough time had passed, enough of the dust had settled, and emotion had subsided somewhat, that people could be objective and be honest and truthful about their experiences, and that proved to be true. I was really stunned by how open people were with me. I think they felt that the time had come to sort of set the record straight a little bit, and there wasn't any reason to spin. So I think we really got candid interviews from everyone we spoke to.
A lot of people have a sense of Bill Clinton's background. He was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. That's a big one. He's from Hope, Arkansas. His father died young. His mother was a bit freewheeling, maybe for her time in her town. His stepfather, an alcoholic who did beat her. What did all this impress upon Bill Clinton as a child?
I think, you know, it's true of all of us, but especially with Bill Clinton, you can really see the seeds sown in his childhood of the man he would become. You know, Bill Clinton had this remarkable ability to sort of bifurcate his life between the public and the private, or at least he believed he could wall off the private side of him and hide it from the world, you know, and that ended up backfiring. But that all began in his childhood. He writes about this in his own memoir where, you know, the child of a, as you say, a sort of freewheeling mother and an abusive stepfather, he really hid that part of his life. Nobody in Arkansas, none of his friends who grew up with, knew about this dark side. But it, I think, developed a pattern in him where he thought he could kind of conceal a lot of the more private side of his life from prying eyes. And that was, of course, tragically revealed to be false when he was in the White House.
He was a part of Boys Nation in 1963. His life was changed, really, by shaking the hands of John Kennedy. It sparked some interest in him in his public service. After going to Oxford and to Yale Law, he went back to Fayetteville, Arkansas, saying that he was going to run for Congress. Now, what was Arkansas like at this time, Barrick?
It was an interesting place. It was still a Democratic state, but very conservative. And, you know, Bill Clinton was suspect. He was a native son, but he'd gone away. He'd gone east. He'd gone to Oxford and to Yale, and people were concerned that the sort of taint of the East was on him. And he had to overcome that. You know, he had long hair and this sort of strange girlfriend slash fiance named Hillary, who went by Hillary Rodham then. She was even more suspect than he was.
Here's a voice that's kind of reinforcing that idea of people not quite trusting Bill Clinton. John Brummett, a columnist for the Arkansas Times.
There always has been with him a suspicion that this guy is not to be trusted. This guy's too liberal for us. And he encountered that, but initially in Arkansas, he just totally overpowered it with his charm, with his political skill, with his ability to connect and relate. In this small state, politics is art and it's entertainment. And he was the best we had seen.
Bill Clinton was a masterful politician, a genius, really, in terms of retail politics. And he overcame that initial hostility or suspicion almost immediately just by dint of his energy and personality. I mean, people were won over despite themselves. And he was 25, 26 years old when he ran for Congress the first time. Within, I think, 5 years, he was governor of Arkansas.
And it is significant that Hillary Rodham Clinton, as you said, suspect, you know, she wore glasses, after all, was not as well coiffed maybe as a Southern lady at the time. She left Washington to join him in his first congressional race. Some of the powerful personality traits and attractions and disappointments that would continue to stamp their relationship showed up already. What are some of those forces?
Well, you know, they're very different people, Bill and Hillary, although they share a magnetic attraction to each other. But, you know, while Bill is a kind of backslapping, you know, easygoing guy by nature, Hillary was much flintier and more rigid and more easily bruised. And when she got to Arkansas, her friends couldn't believe she was going to Arkansas, but when she joined him there, she had a very hard time. She was really a fish out of water. And it was real testament to her fortitude and a real sort of act of will that she managed to force herself to fit in. She did lose her glasses and put on contacts. She cut her hair and began to sort of slowly win over the people of Arkansas until by the time his second term as governor came around, she was as popular as he was, if not more so. That sums up Hillary. I mean, she's just like Bill. She's an incredible learner. She understands where her weaknesses are, and she sets out to master them. And you've seen that in her career ever since. I mean, she's remarkable in that way.
Bill Clinton does become attorney general, 2 years later governor, and maybe overambitiously or idealistically takes on entrenched political interests. Maybe another pattern here of kind of overstepping and a little bit of a backlash. He loses the next race, which takes it very, very hard. And asks John Brummett, the columnist for the Arkansas Times, over and over again, you know, what did I do wrong? Hillary picks up the next gubernatorial campaign, kind of narrowing his focus and maybe even masterminding the first comeback. Do you think Hillary was the mastermind here, Barrick?
Definitely. I mean, this is a dynamic in their marriage you see all through their relationship together. He stumbles and falls, and she lifts him up. She picks him up with, you know, the sheer force of her will and dusts him off and gets him back in the game. In the first part of the film, we start the film essentially in New Hampshire with the Jennifer Flowers story, where, as we all remember, he ran into a scandal that would have probably destroyed anybody else and nearly destroyed him. But Hillary steps between him and the gunfire and says, you know, I'm standing by him. And that rescued him. And this happens over and over again. And it's interesting that this particular governor's race you're talking about, you know, already Bill had been cheating on Hillary even before this happened. And one of the real mysteries about their relationship and about Hillary is why she would not only stick with him, but, you know, rescue him over and over again when he wasn't able to be faithful to her. And it's a real motif in the film, and I think we really explore that question of what it is that's holding them together. It's a mutual love of public service, and it's mutual ambition mixed together, and it's a very strong bond between them.
Well, I think a lot of people guess that Hillary and Bill worked out some kind of deal. She's getting something out of this, too. While over and over again, he puts himself on the line to satisfy himself. Do we get a greater understanding of that through this film?
I think so. I mean, you know, people have professed bewilderment at their relationship. I actually think it's very understandable, and we have a lot of people who are very close to them talking about it. You know, as someone says in the film, they shared a love of so many things in common: ambition, belief in themselves and where they could go in life. So the basis of their marriage was not necessarily sexual fidelity, but the basis of their marriage were these other very, very powerful bonds. And I actually think there was no cynical deal between them. I think what it was a marriage built on these other less conventional attractions, but no less strong. And I think they are in love with each other. They were in love with each other, and it carried them through these terrible, you know, infidelities that Bill seemed to be unable to resist.
And the Clinton charm, while working very well with many women, didn't work at the DNC in 1988 when he's a rising political star and he is making the speech to introduce the candidate, Michael Dukakis. It's a speech that just rambles on. Everybody wants Dukakis. He looks uncomfortable. And he turns it around by appearing on Johnny Carson the next night. There's a tremendous sight gag at the beginning. What happens?
As he's sitting down, Johnny pulls out an hourglass and, and turns it over to the uproarious laughter of everybody in the audience.
Fine. What happened there? I watched the speech, and as a performer, I kind of felt for you in a way. What happened?
It just didn't work. I mean, what can I tell you? My sole goal was achieved, however. I wanted so badly to make Michael Dukakis looked great, and I succeeded beyond my wildest expectations.
So, by all accounts, an extraordinary recovery, and then he goes on to become a Democratic candidate, doing very well in New Hampshire until the other shoe drops, and then this idea that he may have been a draft dodger, but he pulls it out over and over again. And in the second debate with George Bush, after becoming the candidate, he shows his strength again, coming out from behind the podium to answer a woman's question about how the national debt has affected both their lives. And George Bush is kind of confounded. Now, he looks genuine, could be an operator. I mean, after looking in and out at the life of Bill Clinton, is he genuine?
You know, that's the eternal question about Bill Clinton. Is it real or is it Memorex? And there's no way to fully answer that. It really depends on your point of view and how you're seeing it. I came to believe, after spending 2 years on this project, that the connection Bill Clinton has with people, that can't be faked. I truly believe that. I think Clinton has a deep concern for people's lives. He has an ability to focus on ordinary people and their real problems. And that always used to confound his opponents. No matter what he did, no matter how they thought they had him, Republicans, Ken Starr and others, it was always that bond that got him through. And they could never close the deal with the American people. They could never make Bill Clinton look to the American people like he was truly a faker, a slick willy, an operator. They felt that there was sincerity in him. And I came to believe that there was sincerity in him, despite all these other problems he had. And I think that is the real source of his success in life.
Well, we'll leave you from some of the sound from the video, A Man from Hope. This is the film that helped reshape the image of Bill Clinton and re-energize a flagging electorate at the 1992 Democratic National Convention. We're going to take a quick break and come back with Barrett Goodman. He is the Emmy and Peabody Award-winning producer and director who's behind a new film about Bill Clinton, the 42nd president. Stay with us for more. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
My fellow Americans, I end tonight where it all began for me. I still believe in a place called hope. God bless you, and God bless America.
This is sensitive in being a used car salesman. This is sense of a guy being a charming hick. He was loathed because, first place, I think we've all known somebody like Bill Clinton and we don't want them to be president of our country.
Ms. Clinton?
And the wife was terrifying as well. She was pushy, she was humorless, she couldn't get her hair figured out. There were just so many things about Hillary that we didn't like.
We're back with Word of Mouth and with Barrett Goodman. He's written, directed, and produced a thorough and searching documentary about the fascinating life of Bill Clinton, the 42nd president. Barrick, all of this is, you know, of public record. We may even remember hearing about the events in Rwanda or Bosnia or Whitewater and the hatred for Bill Clinton. But you pull it all together and frame it in a way that gets to the history of both a man and a politician. I just wonder if there were any big insights for you when producing this.
You know, I started this project, as any, I think, biographer would, trying to figure out if I could resolve the contradictions in Bill Clinton, because he is such a contradictory figure, right? I mean, he's so polarizing, and people find things to love or hate about him. But what I came to realize and understand about Clinton is that you can never resolve the contradictions in Clinton. The very same things that got him into trouble, those drives, are the same drives that got him into power. The effort was kind of a fool's errand to try to sort of come up with a way to resolve how such a brilliant man could do so many stupid things, really. That was really the insight I gained over the course of doing this.
Part of the pain of this, I think, for a lot of people is watching his affair with Monica Lewinsky unfold in this very public way. You know, this is, after all, the beginning, the very early years of the internet. I remember that was one of the first things that everyone posted was what the Star Report. And also Hillary Clinton, here she is on a nationally televised television interview, in this case, standing by her man once again after he denied having sex with Monica Lewinsky.
The great story here for anybody willing to find it and write about it and explain it is this vast right-wing conspiracy that has been conspiring against my husband since the day he announced for president.
She says this is all about the vast right-wing conspiracy. And in that moment sort of sets the tone for the defense of the president against these charges.
That last voice there was Joe Klein from the film Clinton. It's a two-part series directed, produced, and written by my guest, Barrick Goodman. Barrick, tell me about what you hear there. You know, there is this idea that everybody's out to get Clinton, and the Star Report in itself, we hear from several people who say, you know, this became prurient at some point, this became a witch hunt at some point. Was there good reason for that? Was there good reason for that doubt, especially given the kind of internal demons it sounded like Clinton was wrestling with?
I think both things are true. I wouldn't agree with Hillary that there was a vast right-wing conspiracy, but I would agree that there were determined enemies interested in undermining Clinton's presidency and willing to cross lines that had never been crossed before to destroy him, to set him up for failure. Now, that said, that doesn't exonerate Clinton, because at the same time, he was giving to his enemies the ammunition they needed. He was lying in public. He was stepping into their trap voluntarily and with his eyes open. It's very hard to affix blame in this, because both sides equally share blame for what was a national tragedy. I mean, if you look at the Monica Lewinsky scandal, it wasn't just the fact that it nearly resulted in Clinton's removal from office and did result in his impeachment. It ground Washington to a halt. It began the sort of poisonous partisanship that we have in Washington to this day. It had its roots in that scandal. And so it really is a national tragedy, and it's a national tragedy for which there's, I think, equal blame from both sides.
So these years later, how do you think the Clinton presidency is going to be remembered, and how do you think your film might shape that?
We deal with the question of how he was going to be remembered, but we don't resolve it, because I think it's unresolvable. John Harris, at the end of the film, the editor of Politico, says that the Clinton presidency will be an argument without end, and I completely agree with that. It depends on what criteria you use. If you simply use the health of the country, the economy, the foreign policy, Clinton's presidency has to be judged a great success. I mean, it was an era of unprecedented prosperity, peace around the world. We were held in the highest regard that the country's ever been held in around the world, and that's largely due to Clinton's success in office. But if you're judging it in terms of what could have been, the sort of moral standing of the office, of presidency, in those ways it was a failure. So I think it really depends on what questions you're asking. I personally feel about Clinton that he was a successful president despite all the mistakes, and that he really was subjected to an unprecedented assault from his political enemies, an unfair assault. I do agree with Clinton when he says there was no previous president, probably no president since, that's ever been held to these standards, you know, whose private life has been, you know, so picked over. Nevertheless, you know, as I said before, he made himself vulnerable by the mistakes he made in office.
Barrett Goodman, I really want to thank you for spending so much time with us today.
Thank you so much.
Barrett Goodman, director and producer and writer of Clinton, It All Began with Hope. The film premieres on PBS's American Experience this Monday, President's Day, with part two airing on Tuesday. We have much more on the film, including local listings, to make sure you don't miss it. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up after the break, comedian and the irrepressible, wait, wait, don't tell me, panelist Paula Poundstone. Stay with us for that when Word of Mouth continues in just a moment.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
For Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. We here on the low end of the FM dial are not known for our humor. But each weekend, public radio listeners who've paid attention to all the news programming, the highbrow culture reports, and balanced discourse are rewarded with the oddly informative and extremely funny Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
I'll tell you something. If sugar is poisonous, then I am the strongest woman in the world.
Yeah, I'm Iron Man.
Yeah. What's this idea of poison? Like, yeah, somebody's going to poison James Bond with sugar, and then they're going to call back to their headquarters and say he should be keeling over in about another 50 years.
Yeah.
Paula Poundstone is a longtime comedian and a regular panelist on Wait, Wait. She's performing at the Flying Monkey in Plymouth tonight. We spoke with Paula earlier this week, on Valentine's Day, in fact, when she told us what's kept her career in stand-up going since 1979.
You know, there is no end of things to laugh about.
But do you,
you don't have to look very hard, I got to tell you.
But there's a kind of, I don't know, I guess there's the question is it an optimistic thing to find things to laugh about or cynical? What do you think?
Oh, probably a little bit of both. It's, you know, endorphins are an important part of healing and strengthening, both emotionally and physically. And therefore, I am pleased as punch to be a part of the endorphin production industry. You know, I mean, I consider myself unbelievably lucky to get to do this job. And by the way, a really lousy example for my kids, because none of them are going to be comics or performers. And
No one's sort of thinking, oh, I want to follow in your footsteps?
No. I mean, I don't know what they'll do, but I can guarantee you it won't be as easy is not the right word, you know, easier than lots of stuff. Very, very rewarding. You know, the reward to effort balance is way slanted to reward side.
Well, you do make it look sort of easy. I was in preparation for the interview. I was looking back through your career and some of your routines through the ages. And the interaction with the audience is, I guess, one of your trademarks. When did that really start for you?
Really early on. I didn't consider it a good thing in the beginning. In the beginning, you know, it really happened because I can't remember a damn thing. And so I would go, like in the very beginning when I started out in Boston, I'd go to do open mic nights where, you know, you're supposed to do 5 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And so I would bus tables for a living back then. So I'd be, you know, busing tables and mouthing my 5 minute routine and committing to memory. And I'd work at this for, you know, for days and days and days. And then I'd go on and invariably I would either become distracted by something while I was going on or just panic. And then I'd be forced to sort of talk just about what's in the room. And so in the beginning, I viewed it as just a terrible, you know, like, oh, my God, I'm horrible. What's the matter with me? I don't remember at what point I discovered, like, exactly what day that I went, oh, my heavens, this is really where the energy lies and the magic and the, you know, the part that makes it a night that'll never happen again and the part that makes the crowd in the room the most important thing.
These are tarts from Joanne and Ginny. Joanne and Ginny, thank you very much. And strawberry frosts are some of my very favorite kind. I really, did you know that ahead of time? Incredible. So you've been reading Tiger Beat?
Well, in looking back at your career, another thing that I'm really surprised to remember is you're being very much a pioneer in this merger of comedy and political coverage. You know, long before The Daily Show, you were a political correspondent for The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
And The Rosie O'Donnell Show, which is and you also did the column, Hey Paula, for Mother Jones. How did this come about? I mean, is there any fear of merging politics and comedy back then?
No, I mean, the truth is, you know, shows like The Tonight Show always did political jokes. Although, you know, Jay used to say to me, he'd go, if you make fun of the Democrats, you're going to make fun of the Republicans.
Right.
Or, you know, the other way around, I guess. And I would say to him, no, you don't. I mean, I think you do if you're Jay Leno, but you don't if you're Paula Poundstone. I make fun of the ones who are the funniest. And, by the way, I don't tell people who to vote for. Mm. And I'm not always right. When I did the thing for The Tonight Show, you're absolutely right. They had just, Jay had just taken over. And my manager, actually, had this idea. She had the idea for me to go to the conventions and cover them remotely. And they so had their hands full with what they were doing that they really didn't much have a clue what I was doing. And, by the way, they weren't much help in doing it either. They gave me these passes from NBC. You know, when you go to a convention... Yeah. There are layers, it's like Hades or something, there are layers of security pass. So they gave me a pass for the Democratic convention in, I think it was Madison Square Garden, that got me into the state of New York, but no further. I was blown away when I saw how phony the conventions were, because I always had this idea that everything was sort of generated, you know, the energy and the passion of these individuals who'd come to this event. And it turned out, no, it was like watching theater. It was all orchestrated. Like, for example, they would bring in huge wheelie carts with stacks and stacks of those posters, which I don't know why I didn't know they did that, but I didn't. I thought people made them in their garages. I thought people, why they had all the same kind, I'm not sure why I thought that was. In fact, I guess that was the year that Reagan was a keynote speaker one night, and he insisted on having a balloon drop, even though he wasn't on the final night. Now, that balloon drop costs a kajillion dollars. And by the way, in that room, the politicians are nothing. The balloon guy holds all the cards that night. You know what I mean? When you're in charge of the balloon drop, the pressure must be so extreme,
that's
you know?
Right.
But so I interviewed the balloon guy. I was mostly sort of asking questions about the process. And I think a little bit just exposing how phony it all is and what sheep we have become. And I don't mean that as a slam against the American citizen, because you know what? There's no time to unravel everyone's dishonesty. I know this because I have teenagers. you know? I mean, there are days where you just can't. I'm not Nancy Drew. I can't track down every single thing everybody says to me.
Well, it's interesting to think about what you do because it is pretty distinct. And I think of, you know, Kathy Griffin mocks celebrities. Chelsea Handler talks about drinking. Do women need that pigeonhole, that kind of shtick? And if so, what do you think you do?
I think I just go on and be me. It's oddly enough a learned, you know, craft to some degree because I started when I was 19. Mm. And so I think I've sort of been through some phases in terms of who I am as a person anyways. I mean, I can remember, for example, years and years ago, I used to do a bit about hating babies on an airplane. And, you know, I would say, geez, if they had, you know, flights that were like, you know, babies or no babies, like the way they used to do smoking and non-smoking, you know,
yeah.
I would stay in town an extra day, you know, just to get a no babies flight, you know. And cut to me now.
Oh my God.
How many kids?
I
only have three children, but I was a foster parent for 8 years, mm-hmm. and so I had a number. But my kids, I drive them nuts. If we're out and somebody has a baby, they're always like, Mom, come on. You know, if somebody's pushing a stroller in the grocery store, I always have to go and say, you know, what aisle did you get that baby on? I love babies. I just love them. I think because it's a new chance.
Hmm.
It's a whole new opportunity for all of us, actually.
Do you have just another minute for me to ask you some wait, backstage questions?
Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, I'm shocked.
The others cheat. Let me just say that right off the bat.
Well, I'm wondering, how much does it matter to you guys to win wait?
It matters a lot to me. And, you know, people ask me all the time about wait, and I look forward to every opportunity I have clearing up, you know, what an erroneous belief about me. Yes, I'm trying to win.
I've heard you call foul every now and again when somebody gets a ding, if they deserve it or not.
Well, yes, they cheat. Oh, my God, they cheat. I'm not above cheating, but I haven't been able to. No, it's really, really, really fun to do. The others are so much smarter than me. That's where I feel they're cheating. They just know more about current events than I. They were born into the world that way, so it's not a level playing field. It's really fun to do, though, and it's a fun way to kind of keep up with what's going on in the world.
One more question. It's Valentine's Day. How are you celebrating?
I hate Valentine's Day.
Oh, you're one of those.
I really do. I don't understand. It's grown into a hideous monster, too. Well, the other thing is, and this, and in this way, I'm different than a lot of people, and maybe it's good for the species that I'm different in this way. I don't like sex. There, it's been said.
Yeah, you know, I've heard that. You've been called asexual.
Yeah, and you know what? I used to feel really bad about it. I used to think, oh, I'm a freak. You know, what's wrong with me? Blah, blah, blah. And really, the more full my life has become over the years, the more I say to myself, I'm a genius. Because, I mean, not that I'm the way that I am by design, but really, I'm a single working mom with 3 kids, 16 cats, 2 German Shepherd dogs, a bearded dragon lizard, a lop-eared bunny, and 1 ant left from my ant farm. I don't go to bed at night. I pass out. The idea that I would go into my bedroom and there'd be someone in there with whom I had to have an activity is just upsetting to me. And the idea that I would make the activity more zealous as a result of receiving a box of chocolates is out of the question.
Paula Poundstone is a comedian, panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, author, mother, and Pop-Tart aficionado. Her CD, I Heart Jokes, is available online. Tonight, she's performing right here in New Hampshire at the Flying Monkey in Plymouth. You'll find more on the show and on Paula Poundstone at wordofmouthradio.org, including a link to her consistently entertaining Twitter feed. You can also follow Word of Mouth on Twitter and on Facebook. Coming up, Martin Luther's 95 Theses as the prototypical social media campaign. We'll find out more when Word of Mouth continues. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. 1 year after the Arab Spring, protesters in Syria are uploading videos and images of the Assad regime's brutal crackdown of the opposition. The use of new technologies to spread messages and unify resistance against authoritarian regimes is by now familiar. 5 centuries before demonstrators tweeted from public squares in the Middle East, an obscure minister and theologian named Martin Luther exploited the social media of his time to challenge entrenched power. We know at least how that revolution fared. Tom Standage is digital editor for The Economist. He wrote about the dynamics of social networks during the Arab Spring and the Protestant Reformation in an article for the magazine called How Luther Went Viral. And he joins us now on the line from London. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, so give us an idea of the media environment that existed back in October 1517 when Martin Luther nailed this 95 theses to the church door in Wittenberg.
Well, the printing press had been invented in Europe not quite a century earlier, and it had been mainly used to produce large books, predominantly the Bible and the classics on the ancient world and things like that. But a new format had emerged, the pamphlet. And this is a very short book, doesn't have a cover, probably 8 or 16 pages long. And if you're a printer, it's quite an attractive format because you can turn around 1,000 pamphlets probably in a couple of days. Whereas printing a bunch of Bibles and selling them takes months and months and months. You have to make this massive upfront investment. So the pamphlet was a very popular format. And what Luther managed to do was he put up his 95 theses complaining about the state of the church, and in particular the doctrine of indulgences, the idea that you basically get the poor to give you money so that they or their relatives don't get stuck in purgatory, and then you use the money to build St. Peter's Basilica in Rome. So he wrote the 95 Theses saying, hey, we need to discuss these aspects of the doctrine of indulgences. He actually wrote them down in Latin by hand and stuck them onto the notice board of the university, which was the church door. And what happened was that they started to be copied, first by hand, but then printers started to print them. And then what's really interesting is that other printers took those printed versions and made copies themselves. And that was the viral spread, that when the printers realize that something is sought after, they take an existing pamphlet and make another copy of it. And they could do that in a couple of days. And that enabled the 95 Theses to spread throughout Germany within 2 weeks and throughout Europe within a month.
And they were printed in German, correct? As the iterations went on.
Yes. The other thing that happened was that initially the first printed versions of the 95 Theses appear in Latin. And then an enterprising printer realized that if he translated them into German, an awful lot more people would be able to read them, because although literacy was only probably about 15% in the population at the time, an awful lot more people would be able to read German than Latin, which was the language of the clerics and of the scientists. So translating it into German was one of the things that helped this initial pamphlet, which actually Luther had just written as an invitation to a debate, to go viral. But Luther very quickly twigged. He saw that merely putting this thing up on the door that people were interested in and that touched a nerve, it had been able to spread very, very quickly throughout the German-speaking land. So for his next pamphlet, which he followed up with a few weeks later, he wrote it in German, mm-hmm. and he wrote it in a kind of German that was understandable throughout the regions where German was spoken. So he avoided sort of regional dialects, regional idioms like that, so that he would reach the broadest possible audience. And all he did was hand it to a local printer in Wittenberg, and they produced, 1,000 or 2,000 copies, and then people wanted them, took them to other towns where printers reprinted them again. So he just had to sit back and let it happen, and no money changed hands. He just let this thing spread under its own steam. And he produced another 18 pamphlets during 1518, and that was how he got them to spread.
Unintentional but rapid spread of the 95 Theses is what you write about. Luther did not plan to split the church. He was just opening up a debate. Was he able to manage his message even as it spread?
Well, no, and this is one of the many, many parallels with social media today, which is that when companies try to use it, or indeed just people try to put stuff out there, they can't always predict how it will be used and what people will say. So one of the problems that Luther had was that he initially just wanted to reform the church from within, but some of the people who read his message thought, yeah, this is great, and while we're having a go at the authority of the church, why don't we have a go at the authority of our political rulers as well? And so the Peasants' War, which followed a few years after this, was blamed to some extent on Luther, because he had opened up this hornet's nest. He had said, let's start to challenge the people in authority. And Luther actually distanced himself completely from this. He said, no, this is unacceptable. And a lot of the people who took part in the Peasants' Revolt felt that he'd betrayed them. So that was one problem. The other problem was that the people who became known as the reformers, the Reformation leaders, disagreed among each other. They all agreed that there was something wrong with the way the Catholic Church worked, but they couldn't agree on what to replace it with. And this is very often something you see in revolutions. Everyone says, let's get rid of this, but they don't know what to replace it with. And so some of the reformers went much further than Luther. They wanted to get rid of the gowns that priests wore. They wanted to get rid of all imagery. They wanted to get rid of some of the sacraments. I mean, Luther wanted to get rid of some of them. Some of them wanted to get rid of all sacraments. So again, there was this rather chaotic movement. And Luther spent most of the rest of his life actually trying to bring the Protestant sects into line with each other.
Tom Standage, digital editor for The Economist, is with us. He wrote about social media in the 16th century and the similar methods used during the Arab Spring and the Protestant Reformation in an article for the magazine called How Luther Went Viral. Well, there were some other tools, and I'm glad you mentioned imagery, because besides the pamphlets, a whole proliferation of what we would call viral tools were out there. Woodcuts, the news ballads, using very, very bold graphics. How did these spread?
Yes, so the other bits of media that were being circulated, there were the pamphlets. And the pamphlets were probably the most important, because the priests and the influential people in each town who read them would read them out to their friends, discuss them, read them out in taverns, that sort of thing. And we see entire guilds of particular workers converting at the same time, which suggests that they've all been talking about it at work. So that's one of the things that happened. We also get these images, the woodcuts. And they were used by both sides, both by Luther and his opponents. So there are woodcuts by his Catholic opponents showing Luther basically making a big cauldron with the devil, stirring things up. And then Luther had a friend called Lucas Cranach, who was a very good artist, and he both painted and produced woodcuts. And they produced a series of increasingly graphic images that made it clear what they thought of the
some of
the
them
priest.
Quite clear.
Yes, quite. So you have, you know, devils excreting piles of monks, and this is called the origin of the monks, and that sort of thing. So very quickly, the level of the debate descended. And this is the funny thing about Luther. He could write in this amazingly precise Latin, very detailed theological argument, and then he could switch just like that into German and write in this very earthy language and use all of this really, you know, quite graphic imagery. And that was a great talent of his, that he could modulate his voice for different audiences. And it was a big problem for his opponents, because when they tried to attack him, the Catholics mostly attacked him in Latin on theological grounds, and that meant no one wanted to read their pamphlets, and they didn't spread, and they didn't have this sort of viral impact. So there were the woodcuts. They were very useful if you were trying to explain what Luther was going on about to people who were illiterate or only semi-literate. You could certainly show them the pictures. And so they were sort of teaching aids for Luther and his supporters. There were also songs, and Luther himself wrote many of these. One of the things he wanted to do was actually introduce more music in vernacular German into worship. So as well as writing lots of hymns, he also wrote news ballads, and this was how you spread the news. One of the ways you did it in those days, you would write a poem that explained what was going on and set it to a well-known tune. So he started doing this, in fact, after a couple of his supporters were executed in Brussels. He was very affected by this. So this was sort of the equivalent of a YouTube video that shows you how bad your opponents are being and gets spread around. Obviously, he couldn't do it with video, so he wrote a song called We Are Starting to Sing a New Song in 1523. And this was, you know, you'd publish the lyrics and they would be passed around and copied, and people would learn the song and sing it to each other. And that's how they would learn that the church was doing these terrible things to Luther's supporters in Brussels.
You know, you mentioned the period of intense social upheaval that comes as information and revolution spread. Any perspective, given what went on in Luther's time, on the unrest in the post-Arab Spring revolutionary countries for you?
I think the big debate we've had in the past year is, you know, one of the big debates has been the extent to which social media did play a role in this. And I think we've actually had a very similar debate going on among historians about the role of media in the Reformation. And the answer is it doesn't cause revolutions, but if you're going to have a revolution, it makes it much easier to spread and much more likely to succeed. And somebody has described the use of social media in the Arab Spring as an accelerant. And I think that's a very good way of putting it. It doesn't light a spark of fire, but it helps it spread more quickly. The other thing it does is it enables you to coordinate your opinion. So if you go to a website and see that 100,000 other people have liked a page that says, let's all have a demonstration on January the 25th, in the last 10 minutes, you can get a sense that there's quite a lot of support for that idea. Similarly, if you are trying to buy a pamphlet and you go to the guy in your village who sells pamphlets and say, I hear there's a new Martin Luther, and he says, no, they've all sold out, then you know, even though if you don't know who the other people in the village are, you know that a lot of other people are interested in his ideas, and there's widespread support. And so this torrent of pamphlets, and it was 6 or 7 million of them, about a third of them written by Luther in the first decade of the Reformation, gave this overwhelming impression of incredibly widespread support for his views. And that was why he managed to make the Reformation stick in a way that previous reformers of the church a century earlier had failed to do so.
Well, Tom Standage, digital editor for The Economist, I really want to thank you for a really interesting and thorough look. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Tom Standage again, digital editor for The Economist. You'll find a link to his article, How Luther Went Viral. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can also share your protests, your opposition, your agreements, your messages of unity on Word of Mouth's Facebook and Twitter feeds. Thank you so much for spending some time with Word of Mouth today. If you did miss any of today's program or would like to pass a segment along to a friend, click on over to wordofmouthradio.org. There you can listen to past shows from our archives and post questions or feedback about what you've heard on the air. And we do invite your contributions to the conversation by emailing your ideas for future segments to wordofmouth@nhpr.org or posting ideas on our Facebook page or sending us a tweet. I'm Virginia Prescott. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with oversight and direction
from Abby Goldstein, NHPR's Vice President of Programming,
and web support from Brady Carlson,
and Courtney Kenya.
Andrew Perella gives technical support,
and Dan Colgan. Dan, the man, runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individual,
not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters.
Really, anybody else.
For information about the show, to listen to past segments, post a comment, or read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or use the On Demand tab on the NHPR app. app.
You can join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
And you can follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.